I'd like to begin with one of my intentions, at least for the book, which gave it some force when I was writing it, primarily as a work of history, but also as an intervention into American political debate in 2006-2007. At that moment, of course, we were in the midst of the Iraq War. The foreign policy of President Bush was shaping the world in ways more negative than positive. And in particular, what seemed most conspicuous, perhaps, about American foreign policy in those years was the way in which it ignored international institutions, ignored international law, ignored international norms. I found this paradoxical in a historical context, since my own work on the Declaration of Independence had led me to believe that the American Republic, the United States, was born international. It was born in conformity with international law. It was born very deliberately in a context of reliance upon international norms and international relations in the 18th century. That would seem paradoxical because so many of the promoters and supporters of President Bush were what they would call originalists in their interpretation of the American Constitution. That is, they would believe that the American Constitution had to be understood, has to be understood even now, very much in the context of the intentions of its authors in the 1780s. Part of the implicit argument of my book about the Declaration of Independence was that we must follow the logic of that kind of originalism from the Constitution back to the Declaration of Independence, and hence to ask what were the intentions of the authors of the Declaration of Independence, Thomas Jefferson primarily, his fellow drafters, the Continental Congress in 1776. What did they hope to achieve? What did they think they were achieving by the Declaration in that period? That is, what was their historical intention? What was their intention at that particular moment? My understanding of the Declaration of Independence was that, very simply, it was a declaration of independence. That is, it was primarily intended to announce to the world that the United States were now free of dependency upon Britain, the British Empire, and the British monarchy, that this announcement was being made not just to the inhabitants of the American colonies, now states, or indeed just to people in Britain, but also to what the Declaration described as the candid world, or the opinions of mankind, that this was first and foremost an international document, a document directed to an international audience, meaning in the late 18th century, primarily an audience around the Atlantic world, and especially in Europe in the late 18th century. And that the intention of the Declaration was to announce or to declare to that wide Atlantic and international audience that the former British colonies were now, as the Declaration said, free and independent states, and that they could do everything that free and independent states had a right to do. The Declaration begins by announcing its decent respect to the opinions of mankind and the necessity of explaining to mankind why the colonists were now engaging in a radical and revolutionary act of breaking away from the British Empire. And the Declaration concludes with a statement of all the things that independent states could of right do: to levy war, contract peace, engage in alliances, to do all the things that states themselves do. The argument of my book is that that was the primary message and the primary intention of the Declaration in 1776, to explain to the world why the colonists were engaging in this project, and also to specify the rights that they were now going to claim for themselves in what we would now call the international community, as states in that community, with the effective intention of telling the world we are now available for alliances, and also we are open for business as well. That is, open to military alliances to protect and promote the cause of the colonists in their debate and in their war with Great Britain, but also to say, now that we are independent of Great Britain, we are a commercial republic available for commercial economic activity to flow into and out of our borders. I take it that that's the primary message in 1776, in large part because I tried to reconstruct in the book what I thought of as the world of 1776. How did the authors of the Declaration, how did the readers of the Declaration understand the nature of their world in 1776? Crucially, I argue in the book, this was not a world of nation states, or what we would recognize as nation states. This was a world of empires: the British Empire, the Spanish Empire, the French Empire, the Russian Empire, the Qing Empire of China, the Ottoman Empire. There were very few of what we would recognize as nation states in this period. Indeed, some scholars have argued, and I think they're probably correct to argue this, that the world of empires, which was so characteristic of the late 18th century, doesn't actually disappear from world history until the 1970s, that it would take two centuries after 1776 for the last empires to disappear. Obviously now, in our current circumstances, no country, however powerful or however ambitious, can legitimately claim to be an empire. An empire is an illegitimate state form. No one self-consciously announces themselves to be an empire. I think the last empire, so-called, was the Emperor Bokassa's Central African Empire, which will give you a sense of how popular and legitimate empires have been in the late 20th century. But the world of the late 18th century is a world of empires. It's going to become, very gradually over the next two centuries, a world of states, and indeed a world of nation states. And part of my argument in the book is that the United States of America were among the first, perhaps even the first important states to emerge into this new world, to emerge within a world of empires, but giving a sense that in the future will emerge more such states, not least inspired by the ultimate success of the United States in confirming their existence within the international community. This, I take it, is one of the major contributions, both of the American Revolution in general and of the Declaration of Independence in particular, that it was the first formal document in world history to announce the existence of new states emerging into the wider world. That's the reason I argue in the book that it became the model, the example, the inspiration for many future secessionist movements, anti-colonial movements, movements for decolonization. That since 1776, there have been at least 120 other declarations of independence, inspired directly or indirectly by the American Declaration of Independence, announcing in each case the emergence of a new state or states into the international community, demanding legitimacy, explaining their reasons for becoming independent to a wider international community. When I began writing the book, I expected to find many declarations of independence before 1776, which provided models for the Americans at that point. However, I found no examples of other declarations of independence, so-called. There were other declarations produced by other revolts or rebellions or secessionist movements from the 16th century onwards, especially, for instance, from the Dutch Revolt in the 1580s, but no other document which had used the language of independence to describe and define the status and the rights of the new state, which was being announced through that document. The reason why I thought that the Declaration was so novel in 1776 was in part because perhaps the most important source for the Declaration of Independence, the American Declaration of Independence, was not, as most American scholars assume, the political philosophy of John Locke, for instance, but in fact the more immediate and more immediately identifiable source for the Declaration's language of independence was the great compendium of the Law of Nations produced by the Swiss lawyer Emma de Vatel in 1758, Le Droit des Gens, the Law of Nations, in which he repeatedly, over and over again in the document, referred to states as being free and independent. And I argue that that language of freedom and independence made its way very directly into the American Declaration, because that work of Vattel's had been published barely 20 years before 1776. This was fresh, it was new, but also very importantly, the fact that the American Declaration took Vattel's language was a crucial sign that the American revolutionary was not going to be revolutionary to the extent that it would be an assault on the norms of international relations or the norms of international law as they were understood in the late 18th century. And that's a very important part of my understanding of the American Revolution and of the Declaration of Independence, and indeed of the birth of the United States, that it was, as I said at the beginning, born international, born in conformity with the prevailing norms of the Law of Nations. That, I believe, is a very important historical point about the American Revolution, which might distinguish it, for instance, from the French Revolution, at least in its later stages, where the French Revolutionary assault on the contemporary international order and the Law of Nations was seen not least by Americans to distinguish the French Revolution from the American Revolution, but that also this is a very important point to make as an historian in the mid-2000s, in the context of Bush foreign policy, to say that America had been born precisely to support and to promote and indeed to expand the realm of international law and international relations as understood by European powers in the late 18th century, and indeed that what we all saw going on around us in the period after 2003 was the attempt by one American administration to place the United States outside that international order, outside those norms of international law and international relations. And hence it would be an important intervention by a historian to remind Americans of the origins of their country in relation to wider international currents, and in particular to reinterpret the Declaration of Independence for an American audience, which might seem in some ways to think that it knew the Declaration of Independence very well already, that assumed that the central message of the Declaration of Independence came not in its first and last paragraphs, but in its second paragraph. Those self-evident truths, the rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, the idea of the consent of the governed. If we wanted to look anywhere for the classic statement of the American creed, for the summation of American values, most Americans would say, look to that second paragraph of the Declaration of Independence. Those words, that paragraph, are extraordinarily important and become enormously influential in American history. But not until the early part of the 19th century, those crucial lines, those crucial words of the Declaration of Independence were remarkably forgotten by most Americans for almost 50 years after 1776. And for most Americans, if they remembered the Declaration of Independence at all in those years, they would remember it as the birth certificate of their state or states, the beginnings of American independence in a political sense, not as a Bill of Rights or a statement of rights or a statement of individual rights or even necessarily a document about the consent of the governed. Now, I just said most Americans. There are crucial exceptions to this. The crucial exceptions are African Americans, who from the very beginning in 1776 saw the promise of the Declaration as lying in its second paragraph. That's something that I didn't deal with in the book, but I think is a very important dimension of the American reception of the Declaration of Independence, beginning in the summer of 1776 and then gathering force across the course of the 19th century and peaking with Martin Luther King and the civil rights movement in the 1960s, and then indeed even with Barack Obama himself, who is a great student and reader and discussant of the Declaration of Independence. The Declaration of Independence has held a very important meaning for African Americans continuously since 1776. And many white Americans only really caught up with African Americans in the course of the American Civil War, especially with Abraham Lincoln's understanding of the Declaration's central meaning as lying in its second paragraph. For me as a historian, What that meant was I had to go back behind that very important American creed, behind that understanding of the Declaration of Independence as being effectively a Bill of Rights, a statement about self-government, to look at its meaning in 1776 in the context of state formation, in the context of what we would now call secession or even decolonization. And I think one of the important aspects of the American Revolution, which has often been overlooked by American historians, but is of huge significance for world history, is to understand the American Revolution precisely as an act of decolonization, the very first act of decolonization. And indeed, one of the reasons why the American Declaration of Independence becomes so influential and is so often imitated later in world history is exactly because other anti-colonial and anti-imperial movements could see in the American Revolution generally and in the Declaration of Independence specifically, the origins of later revolts or secessions against empires. So again, the larger story I wanted to tell from tracing the imitations and the circulation of the American Declaration of Independence was very briefly the emergence of a world of states out of a world of empires, and often in reaction to that world of empires, so characteristic of the 18th century, expanding and peaking in the 19th century, but perhaps not gone from the face of the earth, at least in a formal sense, until the 1970s, and still, of course, empire still lingers with us in various different forms even now. Just in conclusion, I'd like to say that I wanted my book to be a contribution to two kinds of world history, or two themes in world history. One, the history of globalization, or histories of globalization. I think most historians who write about the history of globalization, at least in the United States, tend to assume it begins around 1975, that it relates to flows of labor, capital, and information, that it's related to technological changes around the world, which are relatively recent, perhaps the last generation or two. Part of at least the implicit argument of my book was that there have been earlier forms of globalization which can be traced back to the 18th century. I think the authors of the Declaration and many who read it in 1776 had their own conceptions of what we might call globalization in that period, which are in some ways very similar to our own, in other ways, of course, very different. That's the first contribution to a history of multiple globalizations, globalizations of ideas and of law and of things like the state, as well as the globalization of capital or labor or information. The second contribution, which I hope the book will inspire in others as well, is to think about how we might work towards a global intellectual history. What might it mean to tell the history of ideas as a global story, a history of the spread of ideas about the planet, about humanity, about the interconnections among parts of the world? So the history of ideas of the global itself would be one of the subjects of a global intellectual history. Another subject would be the circulation of ideas, the reception of ideas around the world, especially of an idea like the idea of the state, the independent state, as something which has gone global now. I take it as one of the paradoxes of globalization that one of the greatest beneficiaries of globalization itself has been the state. We often tend to speak of globalization as the enemy of the state, something which is undermining the state from above and below, which means the state is an object of the past, which is now disappearing or perhaps has disappeared. I would tend to turn that on its head and say, in fact, the fact that states claim territory of every part of the earth except for small areas like Antarctica, and states claim the allegiance and indeed offer protection in many cases to every inhabitant of the earth, shows that the form of the state, the relatively recent form of the state from the 18th century onwards, has gone global. It is now universal in that sense. At the moment that we're speaking in now, 192 states are represented at an organization called the United Nations in New York. They cover all of the Earth's population and most of its surface, as I've just mentioned. However, I think there's also a paradox here that the units, the objects represented at the United Nations are not, in general, nations. if we understand that in the sense of self-recognizing peoples with ethnic, religious, historical unities, they are in fact states, not nations. And so my modest proposal, a very modest proposal, is that the United Nations should be renamed the United States, better to reflect the nature of its members, and perhaps in the other way around, recognizing the multicultural diversity of the contemporary United States, the fact that the United States will very soon, within the next 10 years, become what some commentators are calling a majority of minorities state, that is a state in which white European-descended Americans will be the minority as against the diversity of other cultures, ethnicities in the United States, that just as the United Nations should be renamed the United States, so perhaps in 10 years' time, the United States should be renamed as the United Nations. I put that forward as a modest proposal for us all to discuss here today. And thank you again for the opportunity to introduce my book, and thank you in advance to my commentators for opening discussion here today.